Good afternoon. Welcome to Line One, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today we're going to be discussing the Alaska Center for Autism, the use of applied behavioral analysis in the education and management of children with autism, and the Connecticut Center for Child Development. Originally, we were going to have two guests, Rebecca Parento of the Alaska Center for Autism, but due to some difficulties today, she has not been able to make it. So my guest is Suzanne Letso, who was also scheduled to be the guest, and she is from the Connecticut Center for Child Development, and she's joining us by telephone from Connecticut. To reach us during the next hour with any questions or comments you might have, our local number is 550-8433, 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. And our email address, as always, is line1@alaskapublic.org. Suzanne, it's a pleasure to have you join us today. It's great that you'll take the time.
Oh, of course. Thank you for having me.
So let's start by helping our listeners understand a little bit how and why I might be interviewing somebody from the Connecticut Center for Child Development and how it might be related to the Alaska Center for Autism, just to get going. And if you don't mind, maybe tell us a little bit more about yourself and how you got to this position.
Well, my name is Suzanne Letso. I'm the co-founder and CEO of the Connecticut Center for Child Development and the Alaska Center as well. I worked for about 13 years in the medical industry until my son was born, my first child, who was later diagnosed with autism, and ended up several years after he was born and diagnosed starting the Connecticut Center because there were no services for children with autism that were behaviorally based in the state of Connecticut.
How old is your son now?
Oh, he's 24.
Had you had other children?
I do now. I have a 22-year-old daughter as well who's typically developing.
Oh, okay. So how does the Connecticut Center interact with or relate to the Alaska Center for Autism?
The ACA, the Alaska Center for Autism, is a subsidiary or a separate program run by the Connecticut Center for Child Development. It's in essence a replication of our schools here in Connecticut.
Do you have other associated schools as well, or is this one of the only ones or the only one that you do?
Well, we have the two schools that we run currently in Connecticut plus the one in Alaska, and then we've helped start about probably five or six other schools around the country and other states that we don't run, but we helped other parents or other organizations start those programs up over the last 10 or 15 years. In addition to that, though, we also have a diagnostic center. We have what we call outreach services, where we provide in-home or in public school educational services, primarily but not always, for people with autism. We actually run a daycare center for our staff children. We have an adult day program, so we keep busy.
24 years ago, you were saying that when your son was born, and you had some background in medicine and marketing of medical products, and realized the hoops that had to be encountered and handled to get products through the FDA showing safety and efficacy and so forth, that when you began to look at the available therapies for children with autism, you were not impressed. Is that fair to say?
That's fair to say. I can remember my first meeting. My son was about 3 years old, and I had a meeting with the school district that we lived in at the time. And I had asked for some research articles on, you know, what it meant to have autism and how do you treat it. And they handed me, I don't know, five or six pieces of paper. And I was looking at them saying, well, these are really just testimonials. This isn't the research. Where's the research? And I kept asking, and this woman kept, you know, getting up and leaving and saying, oh, I'll be right back with that. And then she'd come back empty-handed. So I was a little perplexed, and then I went to, because I used to work in the medical industry, I went to the Yale School of Medicine. I had a card to get into their medical library, and I tried to find research myself, and it took me a long time, and I only came up with two articles. There wasn't a lot back then.
So much of what I hope to accomplish with this program over the 10-plus years I've been doing is help people understand evidence and good thinking. And so I want to take just a second to make sure our listeners understand the word testimonial and the and what that means to you.
Mm-hmm. To me, when you go on a website or you go on the back of a product, and someone says, I used this product, I was bald, I used this product, and then my hair grew. It's a great product, you should buy it. That's a testimonial. Versus if you go to a peer-reviewed, meaning that other people who are in the same profession, so if you're, if it's research about foot disease, and other people who are foot doctors are going to look at those research articles, evaluate them to make sure they meet all the standards for research before it can be published in what's called the peer-reviewed journal. When we're lucky, some of that peer-reviewed literature then is synthesized and put out into the public press, where people who have, you know, that disease or a loved one with that disease can start to learn in layman's terms what that research means to them. So when you see that, you still want to go back. If there's any question in your mind about it, gee, this is really new, really interesting, you always want to go back to the original research if you can before you experiment on yourself or your children.
So the validity of a testimonial versus lots of written research that people can look at and compare and critique means the likelihood, it doesn't prove that the more powerful research is correct by any means, but it increases the likelihood of what is being espoused as a benefit or a treatment is markedly increased, is what I think I hear you saying.
Yes, you said it much better than I. But I think some of the things that happens with parents with autism in particular is because we're so desperate and there's not a lot you can hang your hat on about all of the myriad of treatments that are out there. And there's probably well over 300 treatments you can find on the internet these days. But people want to believe that they can do something to help their child. And it's very compelling, and it's really hard to say, gee, I'm not going to try it because there's not enough evidence. So there's a lot of pressure on parents to essentially conduct their own single-subject research on their child,
right,
which is a dangerous thing to do.
Right. So well stated, and so you have to be careful, and it really doesn't matter how important the person may appear to be who is promoting it with testimonials. I would beg listeners to constantly ask for the evidence, not just somebody's well-thought-out sales pitch on why they should use a particular product, particularly with situations like autism. All right, so let's paint a picture. Let's assume that some of our listeners really have heard the term autism, but really they're not so sure what we're talking about. How can you describe a typical, and that's dangerous in its own right, but a typical patient with autism to our listeners?
Well, I think the first thing to know is that what I'm going to tell you is perhaps a likely scenario. But it's called autism spectrum disorders because kids can present in such different ways. So you can have everything from a child who has severe intellectual disabilities all the way through to kids who are geniuses. So they may have some of the symptoms, but not all of the symptoms that we're going to talk about. So typically, though, kids with autism will have severe social impairments. So it might be if they're nonverbal that they don't understand communication that's spoken to them as well as being able to learn spoken language themselves. If they have a much higher IQ, they may still have difficulty understanding social communication, but they may have a great vocabulary. So it can be very confusing sometimes. But typically, abnormalities in communication, in social behavior, and they may also exhibit other unusual behaviors like what we call stereotypy, which is maybe spinning a plate or lining things up. Those are just a few of the common symptoms.
Right. And what I often see patients do is they may think that any of these are what physicians might call pathognomonic. That means if a child is doing one of these stereotypic behaviors and their child does that, then if it's pathognomonic, that means that that behavior only happens in that disorder and no other disorder. And that's generally not true for almost any of these. There may be individuals with social impairment who do not have autism. There may be nonverbal kids that don't have autism. And there may be kids who have stereotypic behaviors who don't have autism. So I want patients or our listeners to keep that in mind. Does that also ring true with you?
Yes, I think one of the characteristics that is sometimes but not always present for children with autism is what's called echolalia.
Right.
And that is a fairly typical symptom for a subset of kids, not everybody, but it can still be present in other populations as well. So echolalia could be something like if I used to say to my son, "Do you want juice?" And he would say, "Do you want juice?" Doesn't really help me.
Right.
But that might be his response. For other kids, echolalia might be scripting an entire movie or a commercial that's, you know, 2 or 3 minutes in length.
Mm-hmm. And that can lead, especially early on, to the misunderstanding of how that language is developing in communication, when it's really the patient, this person with autism, just feeding back what he heard you say. But I've seen parents be confused by that and thinking language is proceeding okay.
Yes, exactly.
So that is not a normal behavior for young children. So what else do we know about autism? You said it's a broad spectrum of disorders. We know, or I think it's fair to say, it's more common in males than females. And in fact, I would say that there can be some difficulty. Well, there's not a specific test for autism, despite the fact that we may hear about things periodically, but at this time, we're not sure. And it leaves open the possibility that autism may even be more than one disorder, at least in my mind.
I think that's where the research is at this point in time, is that because kids are, it's not a homogenous group of kids. So if you look at someone who has Down syndrome, they're still a spectrum of ability and disability, but they would typically present with a lot of the same symptomology. Kids with autism, because they may look very different from one another, it's part of the reason that geneticists think that while there does seem to be an underlying genetic cause, at least for a subset of kids with autism, possibly not everybody, but that may be a reason that there's more than one pathway to developing this disorder. So it might be genetic, it might be a combination of genetics and the environment. And when I say environment, it could be something like a virus that the mother gets. But at this point in time, there's no prenatal test, and there's no test up until children start to exhibit symptoms that has been validated in the literature, meaning it's got research and evidence.
And that also complicates matters considerably, especially when research is done, really, really good research. You want to make sure you're comparing apples with apples. And when there may be a broad spectrum of presentations of a particular illness. You want to be really sure it's all the same illness and not something different. So it's just at least something to make people aware that we really got to be very, very careful when we look at the diagnosis, when we look at treatment, when we look at claims of that seem extraordinary, that there's really good research being done. Let me remind listeners once again, my guest today is Suzanne Letso of the Connecticut Center for Child Development. We're talking about autism right now, a little bit of background, then we're going to talk a little bit of more about the Alaska Center for Autism. We've mentioned a little bit about what the Connecticut Center for Child Development is doing, and hopefully get into some applied behavioral analysis, which is a validated mechanism, a method to address education and management of children with autism. So during the next 45 minutes or so, if you've got questions or comments, our local number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. And our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. Suzanne, I want to stick with the medical aspects. Hope I'm not making it uncomfortable for you, because I know you're not a physician, but let's anything more we need to say about cause, misunderstandings about cause? The cause is not clear. I agree that it seems like the best research is suggesting some genetic basis, and we're learning so much more about the effects of the environment on our genetic makeup that everything is now suspect of some genetic, of some environmental influences on genes. But we also know some environmental influences probably don't have anything to do with autism. So anything more you think listeners, particularly families that have children with autism, might want to hear from you about cause?
Well, I think in terms of cause, right now there's a lot of independent labs that are looking or trying to look to figure out if there's a genetic cause or if there's any marker that they can identify. Because the earlier we can start, well, let me put it this way. The current research says that the earlier we can intervene, the better the outcomes. But when I say that, I really mean the research has been done on kids, let's say, between 18 months and older. So there are some people now who are, there's a couple of people, one in particular comes to mind out of Yale University. There's been some recent promotion of a new product that's called, I'm going to say it wrong, Placenta ASD. It's actually the word placenta and then an SD after it. You can find information on it if you go to yale.edu and type in Kliman, Kliman Labs, and the word placenta. You can get to the page. They've started marketing this particular strategy for attempting to determine whether or not children have high risk for autism at birth. So basically they're taking a placenta at birth, taking slices of the placenta and evaluating that under a microscope. But at the moment, there is a very limited amount of research that's been done on this strategy, even though the product's already gone to market, which is a little bit of a concern for me. Mm-hmm. Actually, I take it back. It's a huge concern for me.
Yeah. And ideally, we would all like to have a very reliable, very validated, early, specific test for autism so that we could be very certain that we can tell parents the diagnosis, and then we could begin to apply some of the efforts at treatment as that nervous system is at its much earlier than we now can do that development, with the idea that by earlier intervention from the environment again onto this genetic milieu and developing nervous system, that we could even further improve outcomes of children with autism. That's kind of the schema with which this is developing. Is that?
And I think if the evidence were there to support the test, then I think that the next thing you have to look at is that what we currently define as early intervention is not intervention of a 5-week-old infant or a 6-month-old infant. It's of a child that's 18 months and older, roughly.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we have to be very careful, even if this test is validated, that we can't just immediately jump to say, well, then if this kiddo is at high risk, what's the harm in providing early intervention? There can be a lot of harm done. I think we just have to approach it very carefully until we have more evidence.
So how is the diagnosis? How do most of the children you come to hear about, how is the most of the literature that you're reading, where are we with diagnosis? What makes you suspicious? How old are these children? Again, we can only use the most typical kind of picture, although there may be a lot of variety and variance in that.
Well, there's probably four different tests that can be administered that are all based on presentation of symptoms. So if a child's not meeting, the gaze of an adult, isn't turning around when their name is called, doesn't have a point, there's a number of symptoms that you might see, not developing language, not babbling typically. So when you start to see some of those things, you would go back to your pediatrician, and your pediatrician would potentially do a screening tool that takes about 10 minutes to do. If there were concerns at that point in time, they might refer you on to somebody for a more complete test. But none of these tests at this point in time are valid for children under 12 months of age. So if somebody has an infant and they're beginning to worry about their development, they should absolutely go back to their pediatrician, but they may have to do a fair amount of observation for more than just a few minutes before they can make a determination if there's anything going awry here.
Okay. I want to talk just a little bit longer on this, and then I think we really want to move on, but I think it's important for parents. And yeah, I think the general reading, if you read about it, is still that it's somewhere around 18 months to 2 years, because that's when language problems become really pretty paramount, fairly easy to be certain of, although not all kids with language problems, again, I want to be quick to point out, have autism. But what I find myself doing in practice, because of this recognition of the issue of what's called joint attention that you've alluded to here, is that children by a year of age should know their name, should be responding to it. They usually should wave high or bye. They're often pointing at something to join the other people in the environment to look, and vice versa. They should follow your efforts to point at something. So that's been noted, is my understanding, from looking at video, home videos of children who later had very good diagnoses of autism, to try to find earlier things that might clue us in. So I'm thinking that for some of these kids, and again, I'm careful with my verbiage, some we can get very suspicious as early as a year at this point. Is that fit with what you're understanding?
It does, but if I may take a moment to tell an anecdote. I mean, I have a son with autism. My sister had her first child. I was noticing her daughter wasn't turning around and orienting when you would call her name. If you rattled a candy bar behind her, she didn't turn around. She wasn't developing typical language. I was very concerned, and I made an enemy of my sister for a short period of time. But then my sister brought her to the doctor, and it turned out she was having trouble with her hearing. Okay. So once that was rectified, her language, within 24 hours, she started acquiring language like you just wouldn't believe. So there are, even when you have autism in your family, you can't automatically assume that if someone's not developing exactly typical, that that's the reason why. Two resources I would give to parents who are concerned or who just want to monitor the development of their infants would be the CDC website, and I don't remember the call letters for it exactly, but if you type in Center for Disease Control Child Development, they have various charts that you can look at and see where your child should be at 2 months, 6 months, and so forth. There's another website, the AutismSpeaks.org website has a section for parents where they can go on and actually see video of typically developing versus autistic behaviors in a variety of different categories.
And we actually have both of those links on our website, alaskapublic.org. Go to the Line 1 link and you'll find that, plus one that I thought was interesting. It's from the National Autism Centers. It was a manual on the parent's guide to evidence-based practice in autism, which I have a preference to that kind of a title. So there's other links as well to the Alaska Center for Autism and the Connecticut Center for Child Development for those of you who would like to look at it that way and find those links. All right. One last thing. I keep thinking about this. There's been some really recent research that's been promoted on looking at gaze of infants from very, very early in life and trying to make a diagnosis of autism by seeing how well gaze, particularly to its faces, has been done, and there's some correlation. I would be quick to point out that the researchers also point out that this is so subtle that it cannot be done. It is being done by machines watching the frequency and how long attention it stays on human faces. That it's not something that you can absolutely use and pick up by a personal interaction with children. But you may read something about that as efforts to try to perhaps find earlier ways to be suspicious about autism continue to be developed. All right, so The Connecticut Center was developed, and the Alaska Center for Autism, their offshoots, is to try to offer families the best validated options for care management and education of children with autism. Is that a good way to say what you guys are doing?
That pretty much sums it up, yes.
All right. And when did the Alaska Center get opened? And I know you're not from up here. Can you tell us where it's located and what they're doing specifically?
Yes, it's we started in March of 2011. We started with just two children, and we now have we've doubled in size. We have four kids. We also recently expanded into also providing what we call outreach services in Alaska. And what I mean by that is that in addition to the children who come to us for a school-based program, we're providing services on a consultative basis to either families or school districts where we essentially go to them. So we do that here in Connecticut as well. Connecticut also has a diagnostic center and a number of other things that we don't have yet in Alaska.
Okay. And the school is located in Eagle River, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. Yeah. It's the, I'm just blanked on the name of the church. I'm going to be in trouble now.
It's all right. People who want to get more information, again, the Alaska Center for Autism, you can put that in your browsers and find that. So you've been open a couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit. I mean, this is a high staff student ratio, a pretty demanding amount of effort from the school standpoint, it seems to me.
It takes us approximately 50 man hours per child to deliver a 30-hour-a-week program. And we have some very highly trained, specialized professionals who design the programs, and then we train all of our direct instructors to work very specifically on a unique program for each child. So we're staffed better than one-to-one, but it makes more sense than it sounds like.
We are going to, Suzanne, we're going to take our typical halfway break here, and then we're going to come back and talk a little bit more about the Alaska Center. And also I want to get into a little bit more on the specifics of applied behavioral analysis, the technique that's, I believe, that your school is using primarily to address the education of children. So I want you to hang on with us just a second. Let me remind listeners once again, line one, your health connection is what you're listening to. Our local number is 550-8433. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. After this very short break, we'll continue our conversation with Suzanne Letso. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line One, your health connection on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Suzanne Letso of the Connecticut Center for Child Development. With her was supposed to be Rebecca Parenteau of the Alaska Center for Autism, but had some problems and was not able to get here today. We've been having a pretty interesting conversation about autism up to this point, some of the characteristics, some of the problems with the diagnosis, and therefore some of the issues about treatment. And we're beginning to talk a little bit more specifically about the Alaska Center for Autism and its specific offerings. If you've got questions or comments at all about anything you hear today, a couple of ways to get a hold of us. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Our local number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. The program does repeat. It's a taped rebroadcast between 9 and 10 on 91.1 FM in Alaska, or in Anchorage. And I always like to remind people that at that point we will not be able to answer any questions, obviously, and that you also, though, can go to the alaskapublic.org website, look for the Alaska Line 1 link, and you can find archives to any of our previous programs, including this one, to listen to at any time you would like. Suzanne, while we were gone, we did get an email, and it asked, how would a parent with an autistic child contact the Alaska Center for Autism to determine if they qualify for enrollment? So let's answer that specific question, but it leads to the other one, is exactly what are the qualifications that you're looking for your school?
Sure. First of all, God bless technology, because one of my staff texted me. The person who's interested in contacting us can check into the Holy Spirit Episcopal Church in Eagle River is where we're housed. The program director was the young woman who was supposed to join me tonight, Rebecca Parenteau, and she could be the person to be contacted there. Or you can go through our website at www.cccd.org and contact either Rebecca or Megan McCarron. Either one of them would be happy to help her. So let's see, that was how you contact us. What was the second part of the question?
Yeah, what are the qualifications? What is it, all patients with autism you're looking for? What would determine whether the person's children might qualify for this center?
We typically, for the school-based programs, they were looking for children who have signs and symptoms of autism, or that would be consistent with a diagnosis with autism, even if they haven't yet been diagnosed. However, we do also work with other disabilities, and in particular, we would be interested in the future in starting a classroom, if we can do so in collaboration with people who are experts in fetal alcohol syndrome. So we don't have a classroom like that yet, but if there are people who are interested in those kinds of services, that's an area we'd like to grow in Alaska. So other than that, probably at this point in time, we could help families with providing expertise around programming if they don't have signs and symptoms of autism, but probably not in a center-based program. We just don't have another classroom.
Mm-hmm. So one obvious question that comes up is what might be the difference that you would describe between any public school systems offering for patients with autism and what you're trying to accomplish?
Well, I haven't seen every single classroom in Alaska or Connecticut, but I think generally speaking, the difference between a school like ours and public schools in general is that we do have specific expertise in autism and related disorders, and we have specific expertise in behavior analysis and working with kids who present with interesting, unique challenges, both in where we want to teach them new skills or where we want to reduce behaviors that might interfere with learning or quality of life for the child or the family. So we are staffed differently. Our training is different. The level of training we provide to staff is substantially different. And our environment is different. So So because we're a private school, we can group kids in classrooms that are the most effective for the kids in that classroom. When you're in a public school, a lot of times, you know, public schools have to educate everybody that's there. So they may have groupings of students that are less effective, just simply based on, you know, how big they are and, you know, how many kids they have to service.
And once a child starts in your school, they're continuing this school. Is it a year-round school, and for how many years are you able to provide continued education for?
Well, we take kids from 3 to 21 for the center-based programs, all three of the ones that we currently run. In Connecticut, we have adult services, so some of our students will age out of a school system and then enroll in our day program services. We don't currently offer that service in Alaska, but we hope to as we grow. Mm-hmm. So typically, though, it really depends how long someone stays with us on a couple of factors. One is the level of impairment of the student and how old they are when they come to us. So we know we can often have better outcomes with working with younger children rather than if I get somebody at 15 who still hasn't acquired learning to learn skills. Their trajectory of learning may be very different than a child who presents exactly like them but is only 2 or 3 years old. Mm-hmm. So for some kids, they might be with us a couple of years. Some children may stay with us through the rest of their educational experience. In some cases, it's also because there's no place else for them to go. And when I say that, I mean it's a lot easier for us to transition a child back to a public school setting when the public school setting has a variety of options for students that might really be well designed to meet their needs. In some cases, we have that, and in other cases, we don't.
I have a daughter who is beginning a speech therapy master's degree, and one of her first patients that she was working with is a young girl with autism, and she frequently was commiserating with me about the difficulty in dealing and trying to make headway. And that leads to a couple of questions I didn't anticipate when I started that line of thinking. One is getting into the importance of behavioral approaches and applied behavioral analysis. But also where I was going is that it would seem to me it would really be helpful to have speech and occupational therapists and others who are very, very specifically trained, highly trained in behavioral analysis to have an increased likelihood of making some headway besides just the teachers.
Oh, absolutely. And I think there's more than one way to accomplish that. One is to cross-train those professionals, if you will. And you do see around the country now, there's a lot of people who are special education teachers, speech language pathologists, occupational therapists who are going back and taking the coursework and getting the supervision so that they can become board-certified behavior analysts as well. And that's wonderful. But where we don't yet have that, I think another model that's very effective is when you have a team that all can bring their expertise and collaborate together. And that, I think, in some respects, is the shorter road to get to good intervention for kids right now. So a speech pathologist who can consult meaningfully on a team with a behavior analyst, and by that I don't mean, you know, we pass each other in the hallway and say good morning. And I think that's one of the differences about a school like ours, where we bring everybody together, the parents, the school district personnel, our staff, and we provide training and support to make all of those other people around this child more successful. So at the end of the day, for kids with autism, it doesn't really matter what they can do at school. What really matters is what they do when they get home at night or what they do after they age out of a school program anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I want to come back to that, and I want to get into much more detail about what we're talking about when we say applied behavioral analysis. But before we do that, we do have a phone call, and I want to take that caller. Joan, you're on line one.
Yes. You treat my grandson, who has monogenic diabetes, and he's sometimes been said that he has autistic tendencies, but he's never been diagnosed
Correct.
With autism.
Right.
So there's a wide spectrum of different things. For example, he's very engaging, loves people, will talk, but he doesn't talk correctly, and he's been tested as mildly retarded. Is there behavior modifications through the autism program that could also benefit somebody
right.
with autism tendencies?
Right. Yeah, Joan, I'm relatively certain I know exactly who you're talking about since you mentioned the term monogenetic. So I'm going to talk about this briefly for Suzanne, who I will ask her, and I think I know her answer. But this particular gentleman is a young man who has a very specific genetic abnormality found fairly early in the first several months of life that led to the diagnosis of diabetes. It's an unusual situation. It's been reported. It's well recorded. But as part of the missing genetic material that he has characteristics that are very much autistic-like. So that this brings up an issue we really probably didn't talk about, Suzanne, earlier, is that there are other neurologic problems that have characteristics that fit in the autistic spectrum. And so this caller, Joan, is asking, would the behavioral analysis that we're beginning to talk about offer him some benefit as well? And I think that's, Joan, if I'm not mistaken, that's what you're asking,
yes,
right?
That's exactly what I'm asking.
Okay. All right. Suzanne, do you have enough information to answer that?
Yes, I think so. And I think this is a two-part answer. First, there's a number of genetic disorders that have symptoms that present like kids with autism, or classic autism. And yes, behavior analysts work with that population. But I think the perhaps more important answer to this is that when we talk about the field of applied behavior analysis and all of the hundreds of research articles specific to kids with autism, there's actually tens of thousands of research articles about working with people. So if you want to quit smoking, if you want to lose weight, if you want to shave a tenth off your time to run a marathon, if you have another intellectual disability, all of these people, we're all still part of the human race, and a lot of the research that validates using, for example, positive reinforcement to help people learn more quickly or to learn things that they aren't able to use without systematic application of those principles. Whether we know it or not, the principles of behavior analysis shape our lives every day. But the more knowledgeable we are about them, the more effective we can be as educators. Or as, you know, for me, if I want to lose 2 pounds, if I apply those principles to myself, I'm more likely to be successful than if I don't.
I see.
All right. So, Joan, this is applicable to all of us. It's just, I think maybe another way of saying this is the one well-accepted, great evidence to support it, validated ways to help children with many special needs, but particularly it's being applied to the autistic children with good validation again.
And again, Alaska only has one in Eagle River. Is that correct?
Right.
All right.
Right.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for your call, Joan.
Bye.
All right. So tell us a little bit more about applied behavioral analysis. What are we talking about?
I'll answer that, but I'm sorry Joan hung up, because while there's just the one school, there are a number of behavior analysts in Alaska besides just us. Ah. Who also might be able to help in home and school situations.
Right.
So what behavior analysis is really The field of behavior analysis is what's basic, meaning people study stuff in labs, and then you take it and you do research in, like, the real world. So that's really, we're taking these principles that have been validated and applying them to real life situations to help people live better lives, to have a higher quality of life, and so forth. So I often, there's really sort of seven questions you would ask yourself to say, is this behavior analysis or not? But I think the three that I like to think of as being the core of how we teach kids with disabilities in particular is, if you think about it like three legs of a stool, the first one is being able to clearly define the change that we want to have. So I wouldn't say, I want Dr. Sad to be happy. What I might say is that I want Dr. Sad to turn and orient toward another person and smile, say good morning, and laugh when somebody says something funny. I can't measure happiness, but I can measure behaviors associated with being happy. So we need to define what we're going to teach. We need to be able to then rely primarily on using positive reinforcement to change and shape behavior to see those kinds of things that we want to have with greater frequency. And then we want to measure once we've clearly defined, if I say, well, before we started treating Dr. Sad, he only smiled once an hour. Now he's smiling 70% of the time. So once I've defined it, then I can measure it. Once I can measure it, I can determine if my customized program for you is generating the kinds of results I want, or if I have to change something about the environment, meaning change something I'm doing as a teacher potentially to make you more successful.
Mm-hmm. And each, and so this is basic behavior modification to, it's like a, in my mind, an Uber behavior modification. It's when I've read about it, there's even different types depending on where you're focusing on. But what you're saying is you have to clearly define that it's a behavior you're trying to change and what it is. You're going to use positive reinforcement because that's been shown to be effective over and over and over again. And then you're going to measure that's occurring be sure that you're being successful. That's it in a nutshell. But it gets a lot more sophisticated. In a hurry, I think.
Yeah. Well, and when you talk about there being a lot of different kinds of behavior analysis, the way I like to think about it is that behavior analysts have more than one strategy in their toolbox. Mm-hmm. So we might, for example, a lot of our kids have a very difficult time learning what we call learning to learn skills. So being able to match a real ball to the picture of a ball, or to match a picture of a ball to another picture of a ball. So when we teach those things, sometimes for some of our students, the most effective way to teach them what's called a discrimination skill is to give them lots and lots of opportunities in a very short amount of time. That's called discrete trial instruction. But if I want to teach you to shower independently or to sleep through your bed in your bed alone, by yourself, not in your mom's bed, not on the couch, I may have to use other kinds of teaching strategies rather than discrete trial instruction. So what we're looking for is to take those tools that a behavior analyst has in his toolbox that have been validated in the literature and through common practice by working with this population over time, and customize those things so that this child can be successful in their own home.
I'm envisioning that a parent comes in, let's say the child is clearly diagnosed, let's say they're 3 or 4. There may be a big difference at that age in the expectations of the parents and the schools, whoever the providers are, expectations. So I'm thinking there has to be a pretty good discussion about outcomes and expectations and where are we going with this and so forth. Is that true?
Yes. So we would do, and it is part of the practice of behavior analysis, is that you would have to come in and really figure out what the problem is that we're trying to resolve, or a set of problems, come up with a treatment protocol, review that with the family. And part of what we're looking for is to have socially important outcomes, not just for the student that we're working with, but also for their family, for their community, and something that's going to enhance the quality of life of everybody that touches the life of this child. So, for example, if we talk about doing behavioral triage. So we'll come in, we'll meet a family, we'll look at all the things that are going on, and then we have a hierarchy where we're saying, you know what, if something is impacting the health and safety of this child, that's a number one priority. If it's impacting their general health, let's say because they don't eat a well-rounded diet, that's very important as well. So we have to look at all of these areas and then kind of make a decision tree about what are the things that we're going to work on first and spend the most time on that will help this child and this family, you know, stay together, grow together, and have enjoyment in their life.
So in a sense, when you're meeting with these families, again, the expectations I can envision would be very different because you come from different backgrounds. You have a very firm, experienced background and lots of kids with autism. The family has one child, often, mm-hmm. with autism, and has some preconceived ideas. So what you're doing is helping direct the parents and helping prioritize what generally will be the most beneficial approach to which behaviors you're going to address, if I'm saying that as clearly as I wanted to.
I sort of agree, but in some respects, I feel like we're taking direction from the family and the child and where we need to spend our time. Because if a family is saying, you know what, I can't go to church anymore because my child's disruptive and church is really important to us, that we may change what we're working or where we're working on it so that that family can get back to church. Or if they have a sibling who's embarrassed to have their friends come over after school because of behaviors that their sibling with autism has, that might make it to the top of our list. So I think we have to use our expertise to help families define the problems, because sometimes they see things but they don't think that there's anything that they could do to fix that particular thing, and they come to us with perhaps some lower expectations. That's not really the term I want to use, but they may not realize that there are things that we could do to get kids to go to the doctor and brush their teeth or to be toilet trained. And there's a lot of things like that that we can teach and can legitimately be put on a child's individualized education plan that help the kids but also help everybody around that child.
I want to remind you, Suzanne, we've got about 3 or 4 minutes left, and I've got a couple of what I think are kind of interesting questions that might take a little bit of time to answer, so we may not get to them, but I wanted to let you know and our listeners know where we are. What factors in your experience are the important ones that determine the success of your management? And this is a question that is very common for any professional that's treating anybody about anything. You recognize fairly quickly that there are good prognostic things that make you think you're going to be successful in situations where this is not going to go very well. What are the things you think about? What are the things you look for? What helps you decide that this is going to be a successful endeavor?
I think a lot of the time it's about the relationship that we can develop with the family and with the student.
Sure.
So with the student, our goal is to make learning fun to the greatest extent possible, because then it's a lot easier to teach. Mm-hmm. With the family, I think when we're going through what I was calling behavioral triage, but we're identifying issues that impact everybody in that family or are, you know, key goals that they have for their child. So if they really want their child to be able to play, you know, have play dates or be able to read a book, and working with them to either say, here's how we're going to address that desire that you have, or here's the path we're going to take so that we could get to a place where we could meet this goal, then I think when we're on the same page, we want to be on the same page for what we're going to teach and how we're going to teach it. And when we have that kind of buy-in and we can have generalization and good collaboration between home, school, and the players in the community, we're much more successful.
Sure. I think that's a characteristic of anybody who's any relationship you're trying to help somebody. So I haven't expected that kind of answer, and I wanted everybody to hear that. Last question. What about families? The outcome, to me, would depend to some degree also on what happens once they leave school and they're at home. Are families brought in to help learn and implement behavior modification techniques that augment what's going on at school?
Yes. It's the nature of this disability that if we only teach things to these children in one environment, they may not be able to use those skills anywhere else. So it's absolutely critical that we collaborate with others, whether it's public school personnel, the bus drivers, the parents, the siblings, so that we can ensure the success of this student and immediately in the environment that he's in, but also that they maintain those skills once they're done in our program.
All right, final comments. Got about a minute. And what are your last thoughts you want to make sure listeners are hearing?
My key message for any parent or professional working with children with autism since my son was born is that don't count them short, don't count them out. These kids can learn, and with good intervention, they can learn way more than you ever thought you could teach them. So whatever we put into them is well worth it, and honestly, as a community, will save us money in the long run. It may be more expensive to provide intervention to young children today, but if that young child can live a independent or fairly independent life after 21, the savings for the community, as well as the emotional savings on the family and all of us, is just huge.
Listen, thanks very much. This has been very educational, very rewarding for me, and I'm sure our listeners have gotten a lot out of it as well. Suzanne Letso of the Connecticut Center for Child Development. Thanks again, Suzanne.
Thank you for having me.
All right, good luck.
Bye now.
Yep,
all right,
you bet.
Thanks. Bye.
If you'd like to continue this conversation, please feel free to join KSK on Facebook. You can find that link on our website, alaskapublic.org. On our next program, Prentice Pemberton is going to return as host, and his guest will be clinical psychologist Dr. Jennifer Baith. They're going to be discussing what are these things that are out there that we hear about. What about positive thinking and gratitude, and what's their link to emotional health? Does it really help? So why don't you listen to them next Monday, December 16th, repeating the same evening at 9 p.m. on FM 91.1. Pat Yak is Chief Content Officer at Alaska Public Media. Kristen Platt is our web editor and also our engineer today. Thanks for listening. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.